I know those of you have been coming night by night. I so appreciate how you've been here. It's Wednesday, and on Wednesday we're usually tired. If this is like any other event we do midweek, people are worn out that have come every night. And so I'm going to try to get you guys out of here early tonight. That's my endeavor. I'm not promising you that it will happen, but I'm going to try to get you out of here before it's done. Also, what we're doing tonight is in this series. Last night was my favorite night. Tonight, we're doing stuff that is least my least favorite. I don't like dealing, because Jesus spent very little time trying to fix or change people's cosmology and their metaphysical beliefs. And he spent very little time talking about that stuff. He spent the majority of his time just teaching us how to treat one another. He dealt with values and ethics. Tonight, the only reason we're dealing with this is because I think this subject has been made such a mess of historically that it's a significant objection. If someone wants to follow Jesus, this doesn't need to be a barrier in their way. Tomorrow night, we'll go back to ethics. And then especially Friday night, as we wrap up this series, we'll talk about how we can continue what you've experienced this week. But the next text that we're looking at in our handout is Jude 1 through 7. And man, I dragged my feet on this one. I didn't even want to include it in the handout, really. And that's because this is one of the texts that I believe has been sorely abused by Christians today. Jude 1, and I use it for only one purpose. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to immorality and perversion. By the way, do you know what Ezekiel says? Ezekiel 16 says their immorality and perversion was? They were overfed and unconcerned for the poor. It says they serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of what? The reason I bring this up is so you can understand the Jewish nature of this phrase, eternal fire. Sodom and Gomorrah, two questions again. What they suffered, was it post-mortem or in this life? And is it to be taken literally? Now, was there literal fire? Maybe. But is it to be taken, the eternal qualifier here, literally or metaphorically? In other words, is Sodom and Gomorrah still burning today? Oh, on and on and on and on. So this language, when they used it, they understood it wasn't to be taken literally. It was a very this world type scenario rather than other world. And it was metaphor, not literal. Look at Isaiah 33. I'll drive it home a little further. The sinners in Zion are terrified. Trembling grips the godless. Who of us can dwell with the consuming fire? Who of us can dwell with the everlasting burnings? Now put your hand out for a down for a second. Who do we typically, as Christians say, are destined for the eternal fire? Sinners or saints? Which one do we say? The sinners. Those are the ones that are going to go to the everlasting burnings. But notice how the Jews said it. Who will dwell with the everlasting burnings? Those who walk how? Wait a second. I sure hope that's metaphorical. Are you with me tonight? Because who is Isaiah saying is destined for the everlasting burnings? The wicked or the righteous? Now, catch with me. Track with me. The truth of it is, when Isaiah is talking about this everlasting burnings, he is saying we're all destined to go through it together, both righteous and wicked. Notice the language. Who's going to dwell? Who's going to make it through it? Who's going to survive? Those that are righteous. But notice the difference. Righteousness was not a means of everlasting fire avoidance. It was a means of everlasting fire survival. Do you catch the difference there? Do you catch the different nuance, the different flavor? Look at Isaiah 43 verse 2 over in your grace section. When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned. The fire shall not what? They would survive it, but would they endure it? Would they experience it still? So here's the key. Number one, when Isaiah is talking about this, again, and I hate to beat this dead horse, but we must see it in the text. Is Isaiah referring to some post-mortem destination that both the righteous and the wicked are going to go to? No. What's he talking about here again? The destruction of Israel at the hands of a foreign power in this life, would both the righteous and wicked go through that? Yes, the wicked would be purged from Israel through it, according to Isaiah, and the righteous would survive it. The righteous would remain. So again, metaphorical or literal? If the righteous are going there, I sure hope it's metaphor. Number two, post-mortem or in this life? This life. So let's go back to the Gospels. Now that we understand the cultural context of the language Jesus used, notice what Jesus is saying. So in everything, do to others as you would have them what? Do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Enter through the what? The narrow gate. In context, what is the narrow gate? What's the narrow path that few live by, that few are on? I'm not going to do the math for you. We just read it. I don't want to spoon feed it. It's right there. What is the narrow gate? What did he just tell them to do? It's the golden rule. Do to others as you would have them do to you. This is the narrow path. This is the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the path that leads to destruction, and many enter it. Contextually, do you know what he's referring to when he talks about this broad path that everyone's on? In the Sermon on the Mount, that's treating people according to an eye for an eye. Someone does something to me, I do it back. Gandhi said an eye for an eye leaves the whole world what? It sure seems right, doesn't it? I mean, they did. How many think that seems like the right thing to do? If they do it to me, do it back. Retribution, retaliation. That there's a way that seems right to us, but it ends in death. If we allow that to continue, eye for an eye just escalates, doesn't it? There's a path that most people, how many would agree that most people today live according to the principle of an eye for an eye? How many would agree with that? And if we stay on that path, Jesus said it leads to what? Destruction. The narrow gate, the narrow path, the narrow gate is learning how to treat others, not how they've treated you, but how you would like to be treated. How many would love to belong in a world where everybody treats each other the way they would like to be treated? How many think that would make for a more compassionate world? This is what Jesus was trying to get them to shift from, because they were going up against Rome, treating Rome the way Rome had treated them. They were wanting this militaristic, violent Messiah, this violent revolution. And Jesus is saying, listen, you think that's going to bring your liberation, but that's the wide path that everybody's on. Sin and sin, Gentiles and Jews alike, sin and sinners alike. This is the, or saints and sinners alike. This is the path that everyone's on. This will not give you liberation from Rome. This is the path that ends in annihilation for Israel. Think about the Cold War for a second, if we could talk about something more modern. That thing escalated so far to where the human race was only 5 minutes on the clock away from, at any moment, total annihilation. Can you see what Jesus is talking about here? Did the nation of Israel listen? No. Do you know what caused the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70? It's called the Jewish-Roman War that lasted for 3.5 years from AD 66 to AD 69. Violence escalated, and who lost in that battle? It wasn't Rome. Jesus was giving them the same way to liberate themselves from Rome as what Gandhi used with Britain, as Martin Luther King used here in the United States. It would have been a radical winning of their enemies to a different world. Luke 19, 41 through 44, as he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had known on this day what would bring you what? They were looking for peace via a sword against Rome. And Jesus was saying, no, you need to learn the way of enemy love. You need to learn not the way of Timoria. You need to learn not the way of punitive justice. You need to learn the way of, what's the opposite of punitive justice? Restorative justice. Transformative justice. Where you seek to win even those that oppress you, rather than just doing to them the eye for an eye as they've done to you. You seek to win them. Martin Luther King, again, those of you who've been here night after night, I've said this over and over. So this is for those who haven't been here, but this is what Martin Luther King called the double victory. Or do to us what you will, and we will still love you, but be assured we will match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure such suffering, and we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer, so that in the end, we will not only win our freedom, but we will win you with it, and our victory will be a double victory. Oh, that you had known the things that would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. God did not come to you in the form of a violent Joshua. He came to you in the form of a nonviolent Jesus. And you didn't recognize it. You stayed on that path of violence, of retribution, of punition, of penal justice. And you wouldn't follow the restorative justice of Jesus' kingdom. What I want you to notice in all of the Gospels, again, just as Jesus was not trying to get people to heaven post-mortem, but bring heaven into people's lives today, we never see Jesus going around trying to get people to say a special prayer so they can go to heaven when they die. What we do see is Jesus going around where he finds suffering and sickness and oppression, bringing healing and liberation and transformation. And it's the same with the subject of hell. Jesus was not warning people of a post-mortem hell, but of a this world Gehenna between them and Rome, if they didn't change their way. I think of the history of the Civil War. Do you know why the Bible Belt is called the Bible Belt? Does anyone know the history there? Because a decade before the Civil War, revival swept through the South. People went forward to altar calls. There was all kinds of pleading. And Christians in the South accepted a ticket to heaven while still holding on to their slaves. And what that escalated into was a war where they wanted their post-mortem assurance without learning the lessons Jesus had come to teach us about this life. These are the same. The Civil War would qualify as Gehenna. Are you with me tonight? That would be the Gehenna that Jesus would have warned the South of if they didn't listen. Matthew 10:28. This is important to understand if we're going to understand these next two passages. Matthew 10:28. Jesus says, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the what? The soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in what? Now, what do we know about Gehenna so far? Post-mortem or this life? When Jeremiah used it, we know that he was referring to destruction of Israel at the hands of a foreign power. Jesus is not waxing eloquent with post-mortem realities here. He's actually quoting from the book of Maccabees. This is important. Stay with me. In the book of Maccabees, remember, they believed in the immortality of the soul. So what the Jewish revolt, remember we've talked about this, Judah Maccabees, the hammer. How many were here for that night? You know what I'm talking about? When they were fighting against the Seleucids and the Hellenistic and Antiochus Epiphanes and all that. This is what they said. Look over there in your grace section. This was one of the motivating factors to go to war. Let us not fear him who thinks he is killing us. For he is, for great is the struggle of the soul and the danger of eternal what? Torment lying before those who transgress the commandment of God. What are they saying to the soldiers? Don't be afraid of those that can kill you on the battlefield. Rather be afraid of falling into the hands of an angry God if you don't fight with us in this battle. It's the same thing that's pulled today with the suicide bombers. It's not a threat, it's a reward. Be willing to die today for a post-mortem reward. They were using it in Maccabees saying, be willing to die today rather than be a coward and have to face God post-mortem in eternal torment. How many think that would have been a great motivator in that day and age? What Jesus is doing is taking this quotation that was used back then to join a violent revolt, and he's using it to try to motivate them in his day to join a nonviolent revolution. And I'll show it to you. Look at it in Luke's version. I tell you, my friends, don't be afraid of those, and think of the Romans, who kill the body. So far, it looks the same as the Greeks. Don't be afraid of your enemy that can kill you. By the way, why were they afraid to follow Jesus' nonviolent teachings? Do you remember what we said last night? Fear of foreign threat. If we follow that Jesus, what's going to happen? Rome's just going to walk all over us. Isn't that the threat of embracing nonviolence? Is your enemies just going to take you out? Don't fear the Romans who can kill the body. You may die by following nonviolence. And after that, no more. There's no more that they can do. But I warn you whom you should fear. Fear him. And think of a militaristic Messiah who, after he has killed, and it's this idea of slaughter and bloodshed, has the power to cast you into what? What's he saying here? He's saying, don't fear Rome and how they can kill you if you follow me. Yes, you will end up on a Roman cross. How many remember that from last night? Fear rather a militaristic Messiah who's going to come in here and try to inspire you to use violence against Rome, because that's going to end in the destruction of Jerusalem. That's how that narrative's going to end. And remember, Jesus called it Gehenna. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Aren't 5 sparrows sold for 2 Assyrian coins? Not one of them is forgotten by God, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. You're all valued. Therefore, don't be afraid. You are of more value than many sparrows. Jesus is using the same rhetoric that was used in the time of the Maccabees. He's using the same rhetoric in the time of the Maccabees to inspire people to violent revolt and violent rebellion against the Seleucids, but he's turning it on its head to say, don't follow a militaristic Messiah. That'll land in Gehenna. Follow the nonviolent me, Jesus, even if Rome puts you on a cross for it. Don't fear him who can destroy the body. Fear him who will lead you all the way to Gehenna. Matthew 13, 36 through 46, we're coming in. Remember I said at the very beginning, Jesus used 2 alternate words instead of adeus tamoria. How many remember those 2 words? We talked about them. Hopefully it hasn't been too long back. We're closing in on those 2 words that Jesus subversively used instead. Before we get to that, I want to talk about weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew 13, 36 through 43 says, then he left the crowd and went into the house, and his disciples came to him and said, explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field. He answered, the one that sowed the good seed is the who? Son of man. It says, the field is the world, and the good seed stands for the people of the kingdom. The weeds are the people of the evil one. The enemy of the who sows them is the devil. The harvest is when? Did he say when a person dies? Post-mortem or this world? end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. The weeds are pulled up, burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. And I wish we had time to expound on what all that means. That's another phrase that's been abused. But it says, they will throw them into the furnace of what? Here's that language again, where there will be weeping and, what does it say? Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father, and whoever hears, let him hear. Look at as he continues in verse 44. The kingdom of heaven, remember this is not a kingdom in heaven, it's a kingdom of heaven. It's a kingdom come from heaven to earth in the person of Jesus. It's a radical reorientation in how we do life in the here and now. It's based in a radical paradigm shift in how we see God, how we see ourselves, and how we see everyone else. It says, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it. And then in his joy, he went and sold all that he had and he bought the field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for pearls. When he found the one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. Once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net. When it was let down into the lake, it caught all kinds of fish. When it was full, the fishermen pulled it out on the shore and they sat down. They collected the good fish in the baskets, but they threw the bad fish away. How will it be? Does he say when a person dies? This is how it will be when a person dies. Is that what it says? No, at the end of the age, at the end of this period, it says the angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous and throw them into a furnace of what? There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Typically, when we hear this, we think of someone suffering, not in metaphorical fire, but someone suffering in literal fire, and they're sitting there gnashing their teeth in pain. How many get that imagery when you hear this language? There's a reason, because that's culturally how it's painted. This is not what they would have taken it as in their culture. Number one, how do we know it's metaphorical? Well, because look at it in Matthew 25. Matthew 25, it says, his master replied, you wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I harvest where I have not sown, gather where I have not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the banker so that when I returned, it should have received as much back with interest. Take the bag of gold from him, give it to the one who has 10 bags. From those who have will be given more, those who have an abundance. As for those who do not have, even what they have will be taken away. And throw the worthless servant this time into what? You can't have both, by the way. You can't have outer darkness and a furnace of fire. Why? Because also accompanying the heat is also what? Light. So what we're dealing with here is not language that Jesus ever intended for us to take literally. Is God going to take people and just throw them into some dark room somewhere? I mean, why do we take one metaphorically and not the other is what I'm saying. This is metaphorical language not to be taken literally. When we take it literally, we find all kinds of contradictions even among the language itself. You can't have outer darkness and eternally burning fire together. You can't have them. But notice what it says. It groups with it, there will be weeping and gnashing of... What did he mean by this? Look at Acts 7:54. When the members of the Sanhedrin heard this, they were, what's the emotion? Furious. And they what? Any literal fire there in that story? Why did they gnash their teeth? Were they feeling physical pain of being thrown in physical fire? It's called being angry. Look it over in your grace section, Job 16:9. Think of Incredible Hulk. When the Hulk got mad, he gnashed his, think big green guy right now, okay? He's torn me in his wrath, that's anger, and hated me. He has, what does it say? Gnashed his teeth at me. Gnashing your teeth is not being in physical pain. Gnashing your teeth was the code phrase in Judaism for being really, really, what emotion? Angry. Psalms 112 verse 10, the wicked see it and are, what's the emotion? Angry. They, what does it say? Gnash their teeth. When the older brother saw the younger brother being celebrated and he remained in outer darkness that night, do you remember? What emotion was he feeling? Anger. He would have been one who, why is Jesus drawing this contrast? Again, we talked about the pyramid earlier. We'll talk about the circle. Instead of orchestrating humanity the way we do as a circle where there's insiders and outsiders, Jesus sought to flip that circle again and create a shared table where everyone and everyone's story, values, and perspectives are welcome to the table to shape the conversation. How many were here for that night? But in a world where religious people are still operating under circles, us and them, insiders, outsiders, they are to be feared, we're the ones that are safe. What Jesus is saying is, you who are insiders, you're so assured that you're going to be safe on that day. You think those outsiders are the ones that are going to suffer adeus tamoria. What you're going to discover that day is it's the exact opposite. You guys are going to be experiencing Gehenna, and they will be the ones, those who embraced my nonviolent revolution, they will be the ones that enter into the kingdom. And what emotion would you insider Pharisees, what emotion are you going to feel? When you see them as part of the kingdom and you in outer darkness, you're the one thrown into the fire. When Jerusalem is destroyed and the kingdom takes off, you're the one that's going to see that they're the ones that are in. You're the one that from your own choice are left outside. Because remember, if anybody is lost at last, it will not be because they could not accept a God's love for them. It will be because they could not accept God's love for someone they thought should be excluded. And when you see them being included and you think they should be left out, the temptation is to get what emotion? On this day, Jesus says there will be great gnashing of teeth. There's going to be a lot of people angry when they see who really were part of this and who wasn't. The tables will be turned. So let's get to Jesus' two words. He continues on in Matthew with this end of the age language. Matthew 25, 31. It says, when the Son of Man, and this is the Baranasha, comes out of Daniel 7. When the Son of Man comes in its glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory, and what does it say? All the nations will be gathered before him. He will separate the people one from another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the... Now let's do some cultural analysis before we go tonight. Are both sheep and goats valuable to the shepherd economically? Are they both assets? Interesting. So we're not talking about one group being good, one group being bad. I also find it fascinating that the difference between the sheep and the goats are those who feed the poor, give food to the hungry, drink to the thirsty, visit those that are in prison, clothe those that are naked. That's what determines who's sheep and goat. Are you with me? The goats actually say, but didn't we cast out demons in your name? What does that mean? Think about what we were just talking about. What does that mean? Think about what's on the screen. Isn't this flipping of what you expected? Wait a second, we were the ones that were religious. We were the ones that were casting out even demons in your name, and we're goats? What are you talking about? How many can see why there would be a little bit of gnashing of teeth? There's probably a little bit of gnashing of teeth when Jesus was telling this story. So we have that reversal quality to it as well. But then watch what it says. Then he will say to those on his left hand, the goats, those who thought they were insiders and those other people who didn't do things the way they thought they should do them. Those are the outsiders. When they see it's turned, he will say to those on his left hand, you that are accursed, depart from me into, what's the language? Now, what have we learned so far, literal or metaphorical? Literal or metaphorical? Every other occurrence of this has been metaphor of something very real, something very scary, something very much to be avoided. How many would agree with that? It's still something to be avoided. But it says, these will go away into eternal punishment. But notice the two Greek words. It's no longer adius timorea. Jesus uses aeonian what? Colossus. And this is where I want to spend the remainder of our time. Why is aeonian colossus different than adius timorea? Well, number one, let's look at aeonian. Aeonian is indeterminate as to duration. What does that mean? It's not talking about the length of time that it lasts. It gives prominence to the immeasurableness of eternity. In other words, it's talking about the quality of that fire being eternal rather than temporary, rather than how long it lasts. It belongs to that age rather than this age. That's a subtle difference, but it's a difference worth noting. What about Colossus? Look at Philo. Philo was a Greek philosopher who would have been a contemporary of Jesus. Philo actually uses aeonian colossus, so we have an excellent example of what aeonian colossus meant. As we get there, do you remember what kind of punishment timorea meant? Timorea. Timorea was what kind of punishment? Do you remember? It was punitive. It was retributive. It wasn't to fix anything in the person that was suffering. Remember, it was to satisfy the need of the person inflicting the suffering that they needed to have someone pay for it. That's timorea. Keep that in mind as we read this. That's what we covered in the beginning. Philo says, it is better not to promise than to give prompt assistance, than not to give prompt assistance, talking about what was going on in their culture. For no blame follows in the former case, but in the latter case, there is a dissatisfaction from the weaker class, a deep hatred, and an eternal chastisement from such as are more powerful. Interesting. Postmortem or something in this life? Talk to me. Postmortem or something in this life? Something in this life. And notice, it's aeonian colossus. Colossus, according to Thayer's Greek English lexicon, the noted definition of Aristotle, which distinguishes colossus from timorea, is that colossus, notice I'm not making this up. This is what Thayer, the scholar that put together the Greek lexicon, Thayer's Greek lexicon, says. Colossus is what? Disciplinary and has reference not to satisfying something in the one who's inflicting the suffering. It has reference to him who what? While the latter, timorea, is penal and has reference to the satisfaction of him who inflicts. Do you see what we've been saying? Keep going. It's going to get even clearer. Plato says, this is a quote from Plato, if you will think, O Socrates, of the nature of punishment, you will see at once that in the opinion of mankind, virtue may be acquired. No one punishes, and what's the Greek word there? No one inflicts colossus, no one punishes the evildoer under the notion or for the reason that he has done no wrong. In other words, he does deserve it. When a child gets punished, have they done wrong? Yes. Only the unreasonable fury of beasts act in that manner. In other words, only beasts punish people who haven't done anything wrong. But notice why they punish. But he who desires to inflict what kind of punishment? Rational punishment, colossus, does not, what's the word? Listen, if your idea of God is that one day finally God's going to treat everybody with an eye for an eye, he's going to have to apologize to all the early Christians that he told not to live like that. Do you see how inconsistent that would be? How many can see that's a contradiction? Not to inflict out of retaliation for a past wrong which cannot be undone. Rather, he has regard to the what? To the future. And is desirous that the man who is punished, or colossus, and he who sees him punished may be what? Deterred from wrongdoing again. He punishes for the sake of, what's the word? Prevention, thereby clearly implying that virtue is capable of being what? What kind of punishment would you call that? Retributive? Colossus is what kind of punishment? It's restorative. I find it fascinating that when Jesus said the goats are going to be thrown into eternal punishment, he doesn't say Aeonian Tamoria. He says Aeonius Colossus. How many think that's an important distinction to be made? It's not a punitive, retributive punishment. It's a restorative, transformative punishment. Now, some of you will say, now, wait a second. Does that mean the goats are actually reformed by that, being thrown into that? And this is where you'll get Christians who believe in universalism. How many have ever heard of that? They believe that people will still go to hell, but they believe that hell is transformative. How many have ever experienced? Listen, the whole gamut has existed in Christianity. Matter of fact, in the third century, there were six schools of education in Christianity. Six schools. One of those schools taught, no, it's to be taken literally, and it's punitive, it's tamoria, and everybody's going to be punished. Everybody who's wicked is going to be punished forever and ever and ever and ever. That seems to be the only Christian view optionable today in America for most people. How many schools taught that?
One.
Another school taught, no, it's actually redemptive, but not everybody will respond to that. And those who don't respond to that redemption will be consumed by that punishment. They'll be destroyed. That was the annihilationists. It's two. And we're going to have to wrestle with the history. I'm just telling you the history. There were six schools. Do you know what the other four taught? That all the goats would finally be restored. That they'd finally choose restoration. I share all of that history just so you can know, historically within Christianity, this is my point. This spectrum of beliefs on this topic has always existed within Christianity. You do not have to believe that God is going to throw someone in eternally burning torment forever post-mortem to follow Jesus. How many are thankful of that? Let me prove it. If some of you here this week are considering becoming a follower of Jesus, are there anybody in the room that would just have the guts to admit, yes, I do it poorly, but I try to follow Jesus? Is there anybody here that would raise your hands high? Raise your hands high. Those of you who are willing to admit that. Okay. How many of you who just raised your hand don't believe that God's going to eternally punish people in literal flame forever and ever and ever? How many of those same people? Do you see all those hands? That's proof positive in this room that there's a spectrum of beliefs on this topic. And so you can be a follower of Jesus too without having to embrace that. And I hope that's an encouragement for those of you that this doctrine has created problems for. Again, we've got it there, and I want to encourage you to read through the gray section. You'll see that all of the scholars say that what Jesus was talking about was the kind of punishment which tends to improvement of the criminal and not just the retribution of punishment against the criminal. Now, that creates, you know, this whole discussion. But whether you believe they're going to be tormented forever, whether you're going to believe they're all going to be saved, or whether you believe they're going to die, they're going to be destroyed by this fire, whatever you believe, this is what I want you to take home tonight. What is the intent of the shepherd in throwing the goats in? Are they still valuable? Are they an asset? What is his intent in throwing the goats in the eternal fire in Jesus' parable? Is it to satisfy something in Jesus that says they need to pay for what they've done? Is that what's in the heart of the shepherd? No. What's in the heart of the shepherd? He's still trying to save the goats. Whether or not any goats respond, we're not told, so you guys can just keep fighting over that. Are you with me? That's one of those topics that I just don't even get into. I'm not going to settle that debate for you. Do you know what I think is way more important that we take away from this? an ethical understanding that Jesus actually contradicted retributive justice in the teaching of the Pharisees and taught restorative justice instead. And if we could learn to do that just with our penal system alone in America, can you imagine the reformation that would take place in our society today? Is there relevance to the ethical teachings of Jesus for our world today? Even if we just take the transition away from retributive justice to restorative justice. How many can see there's value in that change, that ethic? Yes, 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 yes. I'll close with this story. The early Jesus followers were illiterate, which means they couldn't read or write. And the way that they communicated and they remembered their story was by artwork. So if you go into the catacombs of Rome, you'll see beautiful murals of what these martyrs were painting on the walls. You'll find all kinds of cool pictures, but there's one picture that stands out. It's the picture of Matthew 25 of the Good Shepherd. And the sheep are to the right, and the goats are to the left. And today, when we see the Good Shepherd, which one of those two options is usually on the shepherd's shoulders? Be honest.
A lost sheep.
It's a lost sheep on the shepherd's shoulders. Because it's that us and them. God loves us, not them. But in the catacombs, every time you see the shepherd, and you can Google this, I'm not making this up. In the catacombs, every time you see the shepherd with the goats on the right, or sorry, the sheep on the right and the goats on the left, the shepherd's always carrying one of them. But do you know which one it is? It's always the goat. And you have to ask why. Because if you were a martyr and you were being persecuted by the goats, losing your life at the hands of the goats, would it be important to remember that they are valuable to the shepherd too? And that we should not return eye for an eye, but continue to love our enemies the way the shepherd does. And to die in such a way that we hope to restore and redeem even our enemies. Remember King's double victory? That's the flavor of the early church. That's the way of enemy love. And it was rooted in parables like this. How many is it? How many had some paradigm shifts as we went through the teachings of hell tonight? How many think that this would be, how many of you can picture someone in your mind right now that wish they understood what we talked about tonight? Yeah, yeah. Maybe not on the ontological discussion of hell. A lot of people, I don't think, need that anymore. That's been left by the wayside by a lot of people anyway, that retributive aspect. But how many do you have someone in your mind right now that you wish understood Jesus' transition from retribution to restoration? Can you think of someone? Yeah. And I hope that re-emphasis. I love how Jesus said no. Yeah, it's eternal punishment, but it's a different eternal and it's a different kind of punishment than what you're thinking. I love the fact that he does that. I love the fact that he's subversive in that. Which calls me today to say, if we're going to follow Jesus, then we need to be subversive of retributive justice too. We need to be conduits of restorative justice that seeks to rehabilitate, to restore, to transform, and to heal even our enemies. And that's going to take a miracle. All right, let's pray, and then I'll let you go. I did it! You guys are going home 15 minutes early! Just drop the donation in the basket as you go. No, I'm just kidding. There's no donation. There's no donation. Just kidding. Just kidding. Creator God, thank you again for Jesus. Again, I contend that Jesus did not come to always fix our cosmology as much as how we treat one another. And I long for the day when Christians no longer kill other Christians for different beliefs on this topic. That we've learned the lesson that you are a God whose justice is restorative, whose justice is transformative. And that may we not just believe that intellectually, but may it transform us into restorative people. If it doesn't do that, then it's just head knowledge. It's just headspace. It's just intellect. It's just philosophy and ideas and propositions. Creator God, would you give us the courage, especially those of us who have been raised as Christians, would you give us the courage to lay down the circles of us versus them, insider versus outsider, to follow Jesus in the way of the shared table where everyone's perspective is welcome, everyone's story is valued, everyone's voice is heard, where our differences are seen as assets, not as liabilities. Not as something dangerous, but something to be welcomed. And Lord, with our enemies, would you help us get creative in how that, yes, justice can be done, but in such a way that it even wins our enemies away from the systemic justice that they themselves, injustice that they themselves are victims of. Help us follow Jesus. In Jesus' name we pray tonight. Amen. Thanks for being here again. If you got questions, throw them in the question and answer basket. If this is your first night, tomorrow night will be different. We're going back to the ethical teachings. Even though tonight was ontological, we did weave some ethics into it. How many saw some ethics there at the end? Yeah, we did do it. I want to turn it over to Jeremy and Chris. I just blanked on both of your all's names. I can't believe that. That's how tired I am on a Wednesday. By the way, I counted it. Tonight marks my 19th presentation that I've given this week because I'm doing it at the school too. So pray for my neurons to keep firing for the next. We've got 9 more presentations left before we're done. So I'm so glad that you guys are coming here night for night. You guys are my champions. You guys are here just plugging right along. I hope it's beneficial to you. Is there anybody learning anything? Is it worth it? Is it good? Good, 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 good. Okay, that makes it all worth it for me. Chris and Jeremy, take it away.